Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. My name is Ramesh Vaidyalingam, and today's interview is with Randall Aki from the Institute for the Study of Labour, IZA, in Bonn, Germany. Randy and I met at the European Economic Association's annual meetings in Milan in August 2008, where we spoke about a paper he had presented looking at the impact of increases in parental income on children's outcomes in later life, their educational attainment, and their likelihood of falling into crime. I began by asking Randy to introduce us to the research he'd been doing.
What I'm looking at is the effect of an exogenous increase in parental or household income on children's long-run outcomes in young adult status. And typically, you always have this problem that household incomes are not exogenously given. So there's, you're really confounded by the fact that, is it parental ability that's being transmitted to children, or is it the household income? So really disentangling the two effects are really problematic. And, previous researchers have, used instrumental variables, things such as, occupation or job loss. Others have tried to do the intergenerational things, linking, and it's pretty difficult to, really get at the meat of it, which is a change in household income in and of itself and at the individual level. And that's what I actually have in this example, because I have a really nice quasi-experiment that goes on here.
So tell me about this. Tell me about the data that you're looking at.
Exactly. So it's a longitudinal data set in western North Carolina, one of the U.S. states, and it was collected by a group of epidemiologists, psychologists at Duke University, and it started in the 1990s, and they collected data on young children, ages 9, 11, and 13, so three cohorts of children, and they followed them for their life, essentially. And it started in 1993, and we are going back and surveying them again at age 24 and 25. So we have them, through their adolescence as well as their adulthood. They surveyed both white children in the region as well as American Indian children in the region. So you have two groups. And halfway through the study, fortuitously, a casino opened up on the American Indian Reservation, and there's a profit-sharing program such that the profits from the casino are divided equally amongst the adult American Indian residents there. And so this is given without regard to the household size, education, or income level. So it's a completely exogenous change, which you almost never get in these applied studies. And the non-Indians don't receive any income, any positive income from this change. And we have, as I said, we have different age cohorts. The very youngest age cohort that are initially 9 and the ones that are initially 13. So the initial 9-year-olds, live in this household with exogenously higher incomes for 4 years longer than the 13-year-olds. So that's one difference. And then the second difference is between the American Indians and the non-Indians. So all I use is a regression, is a difference in difference regression model here. So it's very simple. And all I look at is the change in income on the outcome at age 21, years of education. And another outcome variable that I look at is sort of criminal behavior.
It's an absolutely perfectly set up experiment.
Well,
it's really clean findings.
That's exactly right. And it's really nice, this sort of very fortuitous study happened. The researchers that set this in motion were really looking at the mental health. They really, had other purposes for this data. And the casino opening up was completely, nobody knew this was happening. It sort of happened within a year's time. And it was really, I think there was no advanced warning. And the results are essentially that for the treated households, these initially 9-year-old children, we see that by age 21, they have about a third more year of education than their untreated counterparts. When I restrict my analysis just to the households that previously were in poverty, the margin along which you think this is going to matter the most, that coefficient goes up to 0.9. So almost an additional year of education for the poorest households once they are treated by getting this additional income. So it's a really big effect. And there are two caveats I should mention as well, why this program has sort of manifested these really large effects. One is that this is a permanent income change. So this profit sharing actually is a change to permanent income, not transitory. Second is that the amount transferred to the individual households actually is relatively large. It's about $6,000 per year. So there are other conditional cash transfer programs that we see in developing countries, Upper Trinidadas in Mexico, for instance, that gives money to households if they take their children to the clinic or if they take their children to make sure that the children are enrolled in school. But those are somewhat temporary programs. So and the effects that we see in this research are much bigger. And but those are the two caveats: the size, the magnitude of the amount, and the duration, the permanence of it makes much difference. The other outcome that I look at, as I said, is criminality. So we match the administrative data set. This is completely a separate data set to these to this panel data, and we find that not only do we see this positive response with regard to education, but this decline in the amount of criminality that goes on. And it's really, and we have all the types of criminal behavior. So we code it into three different categories: minor crimes, moderate crimes, and major crimes, which are really violent and sort of sexual offender type thing. And the additional income really deters at about 15%. You're 15% less likely to commit a minor crime if you're in one of these households, and it has no effect on the upper two crime sort of categories, which is what you'd expect. The additional money doesn't really deter the hardcore criminals or the sort of pathological offenders, but it really does the sort of low-end criminality behavior. And again, once you restrict it to the households that previously were in poverty, we see the effects also increase in size.
So you're looking at this those comparisons you said between the 9-year-olds and the 13-year-olds, but you also made the comparison against American Indians and the white population.
That's exactly, no, so that is relative to that population. So
right.
That's the four sort of quadrants and the difference. So they're taken as the control group for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think we can take from this? This seems such an unusual occurrence, doesn't it?
I think what is very interesting from this is that, so as I said, there are existing programs in developing countries that provide these income supplements to poor households to get these positive, socially desirable outcomes of health investments in children, as well as educational investments, making sure that the kids go to school, go to the doctors, and putting these really tight constraints on the individual, the households themselves. It turns out that these households do this without any constraints. Here is a complete unconditional cash transfer program, and these households are doing it themselves, which is kind of what you'd expect, right? That these households are optimizing, and the ones that are truly optimizing are the ones for whom the additional income really matters, the ones that previously were in poverty. So there's a lot. What I think we take away from this is that there's a lot to be said for redistribution programs that assist the truly poor, and one doesn't necessarily need to even have stringent controls, because these households are optimizing, and they're going to optimize in the ways that are beneficial for them and beneficial for their children as well.
What do you think about the mechanisms that are going on exactly?
So that's the second half of the paper. That's an excellent question. So I don't have a lot of information on expenditures and consumption in this data, because the first thing you would think of is that, well, additional income means you can buy better tutors, better books, better computers for your children so they become better students. So I unfortunately don't have that. What I do have is some measures of parental quality and parental quantity. And what I mean by parental quantity is the amount of time mom and dad are working in the labor force. So you would think that having additional income, another potential mechanism is that this additional income allows you to substitute away from working in the formal labor market and work at home or child care. And it doesn't appear that happens at all. So mom and dad don't appear to change before and after the amount of hours they're working. So my explanation of parental quantity, the time, doesn't seem to matter quite so much. But parental quality measures. So in this data, we have information of the parent at each survey weight, as I said, it's a longitudinal panel, on their ability to watch and sort of oversee their kids at each point in time. And what I see is that the parents report much better oversight of their children after the casino comes into play, essentially when they have more money. And I don't know what the true mechanism is, but it seems that the parents are somehow being better able to control their kids after the fact. There's also another measure from the child's perspective, asking the child, what's your relationship with your parent at every stage of the way? And we see there's a statistically significant improvement in the households that have this treatment of the additional income. So for both directions, we're seeing that somehow this parental quality is improving with the additional income. And there's some in psychology literature, there's some indication that, you know, having a sort of base level of income provides some foundation that reduces the stress of parents and makes parents somewhat better caregivers and better, better overall caretakers of their children. And this might actually be what's going on, partially one of the mechanisms. It's at least suggestive here that this is going on, and it's clearly not the parental time invested in the kids that's changing from the data that I have.
I'm presuming these people are going to be surveyed through the rest of their lives, so you would come back in 15-20 years.
Well,
time.
Exactly. I'm really looking forward to, as I said, we've got them up to age 21 right now. Now the next wave is 24 and 25, sort of, you know, the post-college years, what the kind of employment is, what the occupations are. So I'm very interested in that, but that's not done yet.
Randy, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.